Hello, everyone, and welcome to the With Chinese Characteristics podcast. I'm Natalie.
I'm Cherry.
And together we talk about topics with Chinese characteristics, whatever those might be. So we have an exciting topic for you today. But first off, I just want to apologize for the delay in new episodes. Cherry and I were in the heart of Chinese culture, the heart of traditional Chinese culture, Chinese values, art, architecture.
You mean China when Weird Mao didn't happen?
Yeah, the real China.
Yeah.
Which is Taiwan. Although a lot of Taiwanese people say they're not, there's something better than China, which is Taiwan. Anyway, we were there.
And it was great.
It was great. I think it'll come up in some future episodes, but we're back now so we can...
We didn't get to see the jade cabbage.
We did not get to see the jade cabbage.
Very upsetting.
That was very disappointing. We were kind of baited and switched by the jade cabbage at the National Palace Museum. Because the two treasures, Chinese people, of course, love food. And, who doesn't? So the two great treasures that the nationalist government brought with them, among other things, when they left for Taiwan, were the jade cabbage and the meat-shaped stone. And the jade cabbage, more than the meat-shaped stone, is very prominently on all of the details about the National Palace Museums and the gift shop. It's their logo.
They were certainly milking it.
It's their mascot character,
yeah.
The jade cabbage.
It's which very is famous.
A piece of jade carved to look like a cabbage, okay?
Yeah.
But, which is, it's nice. But, well,
it's
I wouldn't
nice.
Know.
It's got, like, little, like, bug on it.
It seems nice. Yeah. We didn't actually
well, that's
get
true.
To see
we have, I we haven't
went there,
seen it.
We went up to the
Can't
third
vouch
floor.
For it. No.
They only had its slightly less impressive cousin, the meat-shaped stone, which is a piece of...
Stone.
A piece of stone.
That looks like...
That looks like a piece of marinated
red
fatty
sauce
pork.
Meat.
Yeah.
It looks like, it's pretty real. It looks pretty good.
It does look a lot like a meat-shaped stone. It does look a lot... It is a stone that is...
Like
extremely
meat.
Meat-shaped. You know,
but
we
no
went
jade
there,
cabbage.
And the jade cabbage is apparently in the Southern Museum. They probably only have one at each, you know, so you got to go to both.
Jade cabbage is so famous, it has to go on tours, you know, so we missed it. Which just means we got to go back sometime.
Yes, we got to go back. Well, anyway, Cherry, speaking of old things, what are we talking about today?
In this episode, we're going to talk about the history of the Grand Canal of China.
Wow.
Wow. So the Grand Canal, if you haven't heard of it, in Chinese it's 大运河. Literally the Grand Canal.
Mm.
If you're not Chinese, you might have only heard of it as a UNESCO heritage site today.
I think you're really assuming a lot of our listeners and myself if you think we keep up to date on the latest on the latest UNESCO heritage landmarks. There's
no,
probably
it gets
like,
on the news.
How many are there?
A lot. Hundreds.
You know, Cherry, a dog that can play tennis gets on the news, okay? Like, you know, lots
true.
Of things can get on
okay.
the news.
But assuming that you do know, okay, all worldly listeners. And UNESCO stands for United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization.
Mm.
And it sounds like a very important organization. So to quote UNESCO's introduction of the Grand Canal.
I think it's UNESCO.
I mean, who's to say?
I mean, they probably are the French.
It's not a traditional word.
It's true, okay. I've always heard it's called UNESCO, but I could be wrong.
What did I say?
UNESCO, like UNESCO? I don't know.
To quote UNESCO's introduction of
the Grand
Canal.
You're making sound like some Japanese lady. UNESCO-san.
UNESCO-san!
Hajimemashite! Dojoroshiku!
As you can tell, we took some Japanese classes, but then I quit. So, so that's where my Japanese is at. So... To quote their introduction of the Grand Canal, the Grand Canal is a vast waterway system in the northeastern and central eastern plains of China. So cross China, basically. Running from Beijing in the north to Zhejiang province in the south. Constructed in sections from the 5th century BC onwards, it was the world's largest and most extensive civil engineering project prior to the Industrial Revolution. It formed the backbone of the empire's inland communication system, and it has played an important role in ensuring the country's economic prosperity and stability, and is still in use today as a major means of communication. Quote. So now, I didn't just tell you this as an introduction, though. I'm here to say...
I don't agree with all of those points.
Nally's like rolling her eyes.
Wow. So
just, I know, just bear with me, okay? Yeah. Hold your horses. Horse...
If I only had one, that's the only all I
What's the actual saying?
Hold your horses.
Okay. How could one person hold many horses?
They got, like, reins on them.
but like they will be holding.
Yeah, those horses want to go, Sherry. They want to go. You got to hold them.
Okay, it has. It must be a very strong person. So here's the thing about UNESCO. Okay,
I don't. Yeah,
I think it's a whole can of worms.
Is that how the
and what they
when Xi Jinping wants to send a message from Beijing, someone gets on a little boat.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's how it works. That's why it's still an important
means of communication.
So here's the problem with UNESCO. It's a whole can of worms. Okay. I don't personally like it very much, especially.
Okay, you act like. When did you form this opinion of UNESCO?
Oh, a long time ago.
Oh, okay. So you've...
Yeah, okay.
So this is a long-standing beef Cherry has with UNESCO.
A little bit,
which is now just having the opportunity to surface
yes.
in this episode about
so
the
So I
Grand
had warned Natalie. I was like, wherever I take this, you got to be okay.
Okay.
And I was like, what are you going to say?
Are we going to get assassinated by UNESCO? Are they going to put a hit out on us?
I don't think that's their style. Okay. I quote them not as a formal introduction of the Grand Canal. That'll be too boring because... A lot of what it just said, not the part where it's like, oh, it was built 5 BC, you know, and onwards and all, that's all fine. But like the characterization of it being the major communication channel and it has been the backbone of China. We're going to spend the next one or two or three, maybe, episode. I haven't decided. Depends on how lazy I am. To maybe tell a different story. To sing a different song. To have a different tone.
Okay. I get it, yeah.
For the Grand Canal.
Yeah, like,
do you get it?
A different, you know, we'll turn a new page, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Get a different view. Like, yes. Yeah, I get it. There's a lot of ways to say this.
Yes. So to summarize my feelings about UNESCO Heritage Site Department, if it's a department, you know, the section of UNESCO that is in charge of this, I feel like one thing it has achieved for sure, let alone, you know, conservation, awareness, heritage protection, cultural promotion, whatever. One thing it has achieved
is a lot of bribes. I'm assuming it's...
Well, it's ethnic nationalism on steroids,
mm.
which is something we love, isn't it, on this podcast? Love that. Let me get a more
Cherry,
dose of the Wolf Warrior.
If it wasn't for UNESCO, how would they pick out the wonders in Civilization 6?
Yeah, exactly.
What would they know?
Exactly.
How would they know what to put in the game?
Yeah. And, you know, put it simply, if you get UNESCO recognition... A lot of times it's like your cultural is superior. And I know, obviously, it's not supposed to feel this way, but countries use this as a means to an end and to show how superior they are and in order to achieve other things.
Like the Olympics.
Exactly. It gets countries into these like weird fake conflict as well. And I'm going to give an example because I'm from China and China really is very good at this game. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, in 2016, an article from the Japan Times, China worried over Japan's bid to add remote islands to UNESCO list.
Senkaku?
Well, that's what China is saying. Yeah. But actually, I'm going to quote the article. China has told Japan through diplomatic channels that it is concerned about Tokyo's attempt to add remote southwestern islands to UNESCO's World Heritage List. China's worries stem from its belief that the designation of the Amami Ryukyu Islands between, you know, certain prefectures could have a negative effect on its claim of the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, which is a major source of tension between the two countries, as we have discussed before. Although Japan has explained many times that the Senkaku Islands are not part of its application to the United Nations Education, to the UNESCO organization, Beijing has not changed its view. Said the officials who spoke on Monday on condition of anonymity. And if you look on Chinese news sites, this is 100% confirmed. China's national media or party media
are claiming
that they're just basically reaffirming their claim on the Senkaku Islands, or in Chinese, Diaoyudao. So even though on UNESCO's website, they say that their mission is to contribute to the building of a culture of peace, the eradication of poverty, sustainable development, and their intercultural dialogue, I think this is doing the opposite, and this is a good example of it.
Mm.
So, I'm going to talk about America's relationship with UNESCO, which is a complicated
one. I mean, how old of things does UNESCO even take? I mean, I guess there's a lot of Native American sites, but is there anything like...
America's on the list. Okay. America has stuff on the list. Not the number, like, you know, one or two.
Give me some examples. What do we got?
Yellowstone.
Okay.
Grand Canyon.
Oh, so these don't have to be man-made.
There's the natural sites as well.
Oh,
there are different categories of it.
Okay.
But let me see if they're... Oh, Independence Hall.
Wow. Okay.
Statue of Liberty.
All right.
This is actually a quite long list. Yeah. So, America and UNESCO.
Well, you know what, Cherry? Every year, here's the problem with UNESCO, right? As an organization.
Okay. What's the problem?
Well, fundamentally, like, there's only going to be so many old things we need to put on the list. But, like, and so many natural wonders.
Yeah.
There's not new natural wonders cropping up. And, in fact, it's kind of...
Well, there are cultural wonders.
I know.
And there's, like, things that are, like, cultural traditions that are not, like, material.
Well, you know what?
Which can also get on the list.
You know what? I doubt that was the way at the start. I think they're probably having to find new categories because otherwise they're out of a job.
Yeah.
They'd be like, well, we picked all the things. Time to close the department down.
Well, but they can't. It's a jobs program.
No, so they got to keep... expanding it and finding new categories and doing stuff.
And I feel like I'm getting to the dangerous territory of, like, you know, shitting on the whole UN. So I'm just going to put a statement here. And, you know, if anyone emails us and says, like, you shouldn't say that or correct us.
Yeah.
Although no one has ever done that. People have been relatively nice.
Someone corrected us about the pandas one time.
Yes, which I'm very appreciative.
That pandas like the cold.
Pandas do like the cold. Yes, I apologize. Anyways, so the statement is, I'm going to quote Richard Gowan, a scholar at the European Council on Foreign Relations who studied the UN. Okay. So an expert. He said, quote, a lot of UNESCO's work is quite pointless. I know this doesn't seem like I'm defending UNESCO, but just wait. And then he says, but it also runs an odd array of worthwhile programs on issues ranging from education to tsunami warning. So the work that's pointless, though, the heritage sites is one of them. Okay? But here I've said some of the stuff it does, tsunami warning, very useful. Let's keep that going, okay? It's not like I can vote in the UN or anything.
No.
So America and the UN, sorry, America and UNESCO has a very, very complicated relationship.
Is this the quote or is this you now?
This is me. They have a complicated relationship. And I'm going to quote him again. He said, quote, it's as if a couple who had been living apart for years finally agreed to a divorce when America left UNESCO for, I think, the second time.
Why did we leave? Because you had to pay money to be in it or something?
And... Oh, no, it's more cynical. It's not cynical. It's more, it's not that petty.
Okay.
Okay? It's real stuff is involved.
I thought it was going to be like 2016, America leaves, Donald Trump gets elected.
Well, he definitely is part of it. Yeah. But it's, you can't blame Donald Trump on this one.
Okay.
I know. I wish I could, you know.
That's too bad.
I know. So let's start with when America joined UNESCO, okay? According to United States State Department's website, the U.S. joined UNESCO at its founding in 1945, but later withdrew in 1984 because of a growing disparity of the U.S. foreign policy and UNESCO goals. This is the official language, okay? However,
so
you know what actually it is?
We were in it for 40 years, basically.
Yeah. 45 to 84. Yeah. So this is not on the State Department's website.
Okay.
But other people, almost everyone else says the United States pulled out because it thought of UNESCO as mismanaged, corrupt, and used to advance Soviet interests. So they left. After a 20-year absence from the organization, the United States rejoined in 2003.
Okay.
I think under George Bush.
Well, the interesting thing is I feel like the United States has already some pretty powerful organizations for this kind of stuff. Like we have the national parks and other things. So, you know, it's not like you're some poor country which maybe could use UNESCO's help to do stuff. So,
well, actually, UNESCO doesn't send out much money.
Oh, okay.
It's very much a money generator for them. Mm-hmm. So for the UN, for the UNESCO itself. It's,
okay.
UNESCO is not the bank. Well, I guess it is the bank if you...
You got to pay money.
You got to pay money to the bank. So in 2011,
okay,
UNESCO admitted Palestinian as a member state, as an independent member state. It triggered a U.S. law that has cut off American funding for any organizations that recognized an independent Palestine. So the U.S. stopped paying for its membership. And the U.S. is a money pocket for UNESCO. Before that, it had paid for 22%, which is $80 million of UNESCO's annual budget, which is huge.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing. And this came up, I think, in the World Health Organization. If I recall, like, there was annoyance on, like, the U.S., I think, pays a lot of money into these into some U.N. organizations and world organizations like the WHO. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it's just because we don't spend the effort, but for whatever reason, politically, we tend not to have much influence in them, even though we often give a lot of money. I feel like we could if we tried, but it just doesn't seem to be a priority. So I think you saw, like, at the beginning of COVID with the WHO and China, like, China clearly had way more pull with the World Health Organization than the U.S. did.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of the kind of the way they were looking at stuff and the conclusions that they came to, which now that things have gone on, and I think the U.S. is more involved with the WHO, probably because we have a different president, but they basically reversed course on a lot of those things and have said, like, well...
Why do you think that is?
Why don't we have a lot of political...
Yeah, or you don't, you're not, don't seem to be interested in having a lot of political influence.
I just think the U.S., I mean, I think in a way we, I think we're bad at soft power.
Really? Okay.
Like, in terms of political soft power, I think we're good at cultural and economic and military, like, power. But I just think, like, political soft power, we're kind of bad at. The way that we run our system, and you have to appoint people and they're changing out all the time, and, you know, you have political fights over appointments and stuff, and a lot of these positions are given out as rewards by the incoming administrations and stuff. Right. So I don't know, it just doesn't seem like we have we put a lot of effort into these areas.
I have a different theory.
Oh, okay.
Might be a little bit more cynical. I agree with the statement.
Yeah.
But I have a theory. Why do you think that is? I feel maybe this is a little bit too cynical.
Yeah.
I feel like America has a certain arrogance.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're thinking, like, trusting or wanting to propping up a organization like UN.
Yeah.
Because why would you want, you know, a separate body of power to have the authority? You could just do things yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes, right? You know? That's the more cynical view of it.
No, I think that's kind of true. I think it's because the U.S. can unilaterally do things.
Yeah.
Sometimes that the entire UN can't do together. So I think there's a sense of, like, okay, you know, we got to be a member of this thing. We got to, like, play the game, you know, be nice. But it's like, if we don't agree with it, we just won't do it. Yeah.
Also, the UN has other voting members that are not. China's not going to agree to do something. What is America going to do? Nothing. So why would you stay in that organization?
Also, also just to be real, I mean, like, there is some important stuff the UN does. Like, it is...
No, there's a lot of stuff that
it does. Yeah. It is important just to have a room where all these people can go and talk.
Absolutely, yeah.
But also, though, it's like, it's useless as an organization to actually do anything. When you have Russia invading Ukraine and Russia's on the Security Council... The UN
doesn't have an army, too.
Yeah, when there's human rights... When Russia's, like, kidnapping children and torturing people to death.
Yeah.
And it's like, who's on the Human Rights Commission? Oh, it's Russia. So, like...
No, exactly.
Turns out, nothing bad happened in Ukraine. Right?
Absolutely nothing, yeah. So, according to them.
Yeah, according to them. So, yeah. The whole thing can be a little farcical, I think, at times.
Well, same for the UNESCO as well, which is under, you know, which is part of the U.S.
Although, I don't agree with the law saying that the U.S. should not pay for organizations that recognize
Palestine. Oh, well, you know, that's way before. You know, so it got triggered. And this is America, so you can't just bypass laws sometimes. No. So, unless you're Trump.
Unless you bring a mob to the Capitol. But even then.
Unless you do that,
even then.
Well, it's arguable if you did bring it, apparently, according to you. But
hopefully it'll be...
When I say you, I don't mean Natalie.
It'll be argued in the court.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so because the U.S. stopped paying for 22% of the budget...
They had a funding crisis?
Well, they suspended U.S. voting rights. They're like, no money, no voting rights.
Okay.
So the U.S. really hasn't been a real UNESCO member for a while since then, since 2013. But the U.S. hasn't officially withdrew.
Okay.
But Trump administration made it official.
Okay.
And that action scored a domestic public relations coup with apparently pro-Israel, anti-UN conservatives in the process. What an opportunity.
So I'm assuming then that leaves, as always, the country that also doesn't listen to the UN, but is very happy to pay money to things and kiss their butts and tell them they're great, which is China.
It's not over yet for the U.S. The U.S., when it left officially in 2018 under the Trump administration, cited that UNESCO owes millions of dollars to the United States, apparently.
Okay.
So now it's, you know, who owes who money. But so it's a whole can of worms, and it can get quite complicated in terms of international relationships go. When Japan applies for the, in the Japan incident, I'll call it that, China really used it to advance its own goal in stirring up nationalism feelings, I guess. Boycott Japan again. So this whole can of worms stirs up ethnic nationalism on steroids, especially in China's case. Another good example is that
because it's basically giving a stamp that's saying, you are a real culture. This is your exciting rock. You're important. you're eternal. You know, and you're like a real group of people as opposed to just like some tribe or something, you know, like you're a real official.
As if culture needs a stamp in order to even exist. So another good example is that in the nationalist corners of the Chinese internet, which today is almost every corner of the Chinese internet, seems to get pretty unhappy whenever Korea gets a new World Heritage Site recognized, or even if Korea is applying for one. They go, it's all Chinese. They stole it from us. Whatever they're they're claiming, whatever. You know, kimchi, I don't know if actually Korea didn't submit kimchi.
Some gate somewhere, you know, some temple.
Some Confucius holiday they have. It came from us. So actually, I wrote, they get pretty unhappy. I feel like they get pretty happy because it's another opportunity
to complain.
To complain and flex. Like, and to try to push for this, everything came from, East Asian come from China.
Let me tell you, narrative. No one got more excited whenever Trump did anything than all the people who are the most anti-Trump online. It's like, oh boy, well, what did he do today? You know, like, let's tune in, you know?
I think a lot of them, like the late night show hosts, right, are like, man, Trump gave me a second career. Like, this is crazy. A
lot of material.
This is great, yeah.
So this is for the Chinese little pinkies.
Yes, and the State Department, not State Department, sorry, the state media.
Well, state media,
really milks it.
They've got like 30 newspapers to fill up. They gotta...
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you think that you might think, oh, you know, we want to get on the list because we'll get funding, we'll get preservation efforts, we might get tourism, right? It's all great. But actually, even to just apply for a nomination can cost a lot. So on average, it's $22,000. And this cost is borne by the World Heritage Fund. However, your country must pay into it. So the participating country will contribute towards the fund every year. And I'm mentioning this because you think $22,000 is not a large amount of money. Oh, however, you know, like countries are rich, right? Governments are rich. What's a big deal if they apply for it? But actually, if you're like, say, a small town in China, that's a, it's a lot of money in order to get this together and try to apply for it.
And that's, I'm assuming, that's just the start, right? You got to do all sorts of other things that are going to cost more money.
Yes. So, but you sometimes are, as a local government, are almost forced into doing it because it's politically advantageous.
So if you're like a local governor and during your reign, as it were, you got some...
You want to waste money on this,
you got
right?
some sort of temple as a World Heritage Site, that's going to be a feather in your cap, you know?
So you want to do it. So that's just some of the sins of the of the UNESCO, and I don't think we can waste too much time on it. So I'll just say that... Too much more time. So I will just say that at least the World Heritage Site of UNESCO as an organization is inherently political, so long as national borders between countries still exist. And what they say about the Grand Canal, because I don't trust them, and because what they say aligns with the Chinese government's political propaganda very, very closely, what a coincidence. We are going to use the next 2 to 3 episodes to examine the history of the Grand Canal and see if it really does show how great China is. So now we can actually start the episode.
Okay.
So Natalie... We've been doing this podcast for a while.
We have.
50-something episodes later, we probably have said China is a big place many times.
We have.
Well, today I'm going to say something different. I'm going to say China wasn't always a big place. I'm pretty pleased with myself. The story of the Grand Canal in China started way before the first shovel was dug into the ground by the conscripted laborers in the Sui Dynasty. At this time, when the story began, there were many, many Chinas. Or you can say many, many small Chinas. China wasn't a big place.
There are many kingdoms.
Many kingdoms. And this was the Warring Period.
You're saying like the Spring and Autumn.
The Spring and Autumn period. The
time of Confucius.
Yes. Time of like 100 houses all sing together.
Confucius and Lao Tzu.
And Lao Tzu's time, yes.
Taoism, Confucianism.
Yes. So China has a long history of canal construction. Mm-hmm. At least it started at this time, but we think it dates back to ancient times.
I mean, it's not a complicated concept. You see a river and you're like, wouldn't it be nice if part of the river went over here?
You would be terrible at writing propaganda now.
I mean, and then you start digging a ditch.
You'd be like, you're just digging a ditch.
I mean, that is what it is.
No,
you know, like,
it's canal construction. Okay?
Obviously it can be complicated, but people realize, you can't go uphill. You know, people realize
what gravity is.
Yeah, but
even though they didn't have a name for it.
There are ways of making canals go uphills. But I think as soon as there were people and as soon as there were shovels, people tried to make water go to new places.
Yes. So the first recorded instance of canal construction in China dates back to the 5th century BC during the Warring State period.
That's not true.
The first written? Mm-hmm. How is it not true?
Dayu.
Okay, that's not a written.
It's a written legend.
No, that's like a Greek. No, that's not a written record.
It's written. No, it's a record.
So you're saying
Dayu didn't like subdue a magic.
I don't know if Dayu existed.
Magical turtle and like have it like dig canals and like build dams and stuff or whatever he did.
I don't know.
Save China from
the
floods.
Are you saying Sisyphus actually pushed the stone up the hill many, many times and
he's still kept at it?
He's still doing it. Okay, cool.
Just like us in this podcast.
Okay, so after. Aside from Dayu, the legend, the man himself.
Okay.
Okay. We have a record.
Dayu, by the way, is we talked about in the last Yu the Great, which is mythical. It's like Chinese Noah.
So in the 5th century BC, during the Warring State period, which was a time of political upheaval and warfares, and states compete with each other over territories and more. Right, it's a highly competitive time in China. I don't know if there was a China, by the way. I know, in the region known as China. Yeah.
Because there is China an area today. Called like China proper, which is the...
The plain?
Yeah.
The continent?
Yeah.
Whatever, that part of the continent?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the most significant canal construction projects that happened during this time period was undertaken by the state of Chu in present-day Hubei province, which Hubei translates to...
South of the river?
North of the lake.
River? Oh, north of the lake.
Yeah. North of the river is a different province name. Okay, you got it. Get your facts straight. So the Chu state constructed a canal that connected the Yangtze River to the Xiang River, which flowed through the Chu territories. The construction helped the state to develop a...
You sure it's the Yangtze River, not the Yellow River?
Yeah, it's the Yangtze River to the Xiang River. You know, okay, not all China is the Yellow River, okay? This construction helped the state to develop a prosperous agricultural economy by facilitating transportation of rice and other crops. Mm. And so this was, again, I will say, the first recorded record of infrastructure building by a Chinese state at that time to advance its own goals and its position in competition with other states. So other states also constructed canals during this period. For example, the state of Wei constructed a canal to connect the Yellow River to the Huai River. And the state of Zhao, which constructed a canal to connect the Fen River to the Yellow River.
So we're playing Civilization 6 now.
Exactly. Everyone's building waterways.
Yeah.
These canals would improve trade and commerce between different regions. And they also played a role in military logistics and transportation.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, so most large civilizations have grown up around either the ocean or rivers because...
Well, you need water.
Well, but also if you just think about it like farming, right?
Mm-hmm.
You farm stuff, you cut it down, and then you have to get it someplace. And it's like, it has a shelf life as soon as you cut it down. And it's like, if you don't have stuff like, if you don't have water travel... It means anything that moves that rice also eats rice.
That's true.
And this is the same thing like with gas. Like the military has tables of like how far can you move gas with trucks before the trucks use more gas than they can carry, right?
Yes.
And so building these waterways is not just get stuff there faster. It also, you know, you use less of it in the transportation of the goods.
Well, these people back in the 5th century BC thought alike.
Mm-hmm.
So the construction of canals during this time period laid the foundation for the massive massive engineering projects of the later dynasties. And the Grand Canal, constructed in the Sui and Tang dynasties, a lot of part of it would be based on the water projects that came before it.
Well, I think it's important, which I'm assuming you're going to get into, when you say the Grand Canal done by these people, because almost every Grand Canal is going to be a completely different operation going in a different direction.
Yeah, no, using it's not different just water one, routes. It's not just one line you draw on the paper.
It's not a Grand Canal. It's you know what I mean? It's not like...
So a lot of the parts of the Grand Canal, if we are treating it as one entity, which is more complicated than that. So after that, throughout the next hundreds of years in China, canal construction and water projects never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
There are more intensive periods and, you know, less intensive periods, as we have discussed, for example, in the Yellow River episode, when the emperor has or is in the process of losing his mandate.
Yeah.
You know, we do less. Otherwise, we do more.
Yeah.
Refer to the Yellow River episodes. But now let's fast forward to the Sui Dynasty.
Okay.
The Sui Dynasty, 581 to 618 AD.
Okay.
Was the first dynasty in China to unify the north and the south regions of China after several centuries of division and instability.
And when you say it's north and south, it's still not...
all of China.
Not
it's very small, by the way.
What we would consider China today.
Yes.
Or what China would want you to consider to be China today.
Yes. So one of the most significant achievements of the Sui Dynasty, obviously if we're talking about it in this episode, for the Grand Canal, is... the Grand Canal,
their
version of the Grand Canal, which connected the Yellow River in the north to the Yangtze River in the south. The interesting thing about the Sui Dynasty was that this was a relatively short-lived dynasty in China. It only lasted 37 years, from 581 to 618. Contrary to its short lifespan, the court achieved a lot in 37 years. It established a centralized imperial bureaucracy. We need to rule over this united China now.
Mm-hmm.
It standardized weights and measures. It constructed the Grand Canal. Obviously, if we're talking about this dynasty in this episode.
It constructed its Grand Canal. Yeah.
At a pretty astonishing speed. And however, this was one of those peak, early, then crash and burn situations.
Mm.
Part of that can be blamed on the Grand Canal project. On a Grand Canal project.
Yeah.
High taxes due to the high cost. Heavy and cruel conscription rules to supply laborers for the project, etc., etc. And that also means rebellions, unrest. And the second Sui emperor, there were only two, was eventually assassinated by his own officials during a military campaign against, I can't pronounce this, so I'm just going to say Korea.
Okay. Okay.
Wherever, you know, Korea is today. That territory and the modern-day Korea. Modern-day Korea.
Okay.
And by the way, he tried to take the Korea territory at the time four times and never succeeded.
Wow.
And that really, you know, he didn't give up. So eventually he was made to. So So after the Sui Dynasty, this short-lived dynasty, we were followed by the Tang Dynasty, which... we've talked about many times in our episode. You know, it's like every time I went to be like, oh, make China great again. If that's a campaign slogan, which it's not because we don't have democracy. But but if it is, you know, that would be, you know, when Donald Trump said, make America great again. Yeah. This will be the time to make that China was great. But the Tang Dynasty inherited many of the Sui Dynasty's political and cultural achievements and expanded upon them.
Well, that's the thing about when, like...
it is often regarded as a high point in Chinese civilization.
But, no, what I was going to say is, like, we talk about dynasties falling, and sometimes it's like, oh, the capital gets burned down, and there's a whole new thing. But oftentimes it's not. Often it's just...
an improved version of itself.
a different group of oligarchs.
Yeah.
A different group of powerful people within China end up taking control, but most of the mechanics still stay there.
Yeah, exactly. So the Tang Dynasty was very much a continued version of the Sui Dynasty. Mm. Maybe less of the, you know, let's invade Korea four times. So let's talk about the second emperor of the Sui Dynasty, the crazy guy who was responsible for all the projects and the crash and the burn.
Mm.
Of the dynasty's fate. The Sui Yang Emperor, he was, again, if he had a campaign slogan, he would be like, I'm a infrastructure guy. Okay? his few main projects.
Yeah.
First, the major construction in Luoyang City as his new capital. Second project, a Grand Canal.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've learned. Instead of saying the Grand Canal, I'm saying a Grand Canal. So only second year into his reign, in 605, he wasn't wasting any time. He decided, I want Grand Canals. I want water projects. I want major ones. I want to connect all these rivers.
He pulls out
this
a map.
This is when I do it.
He pulls out a map. He's like, here to here.
Yeah.
Start digging.
Exactly. Also, he was like, let's build more of the Great Wall. He was into building things. In terms of the Grand Canal, one could argue there was a need for more transportation routes between the south and the north of China, because the two rivers, the two mother rivers of China, they all go west to east.
Because China, by and large, itself goes west to east, right? You have Tibet and the highlands, and then you slope down towards the ocean. So there's not many rivers that go crisscrossing.
Up and down, vertically speaking, if you are looking at a world map today,
was
north up. So arguably, there are some reasons, benefits for doing this, right? You might also ask, why not the ocean? Why are we making things out of nothing when there's the whole body of water over there? But maybe later on, the ocean is actually more suitable for these sort of things, transportation of grain, for commerce. But at this time, I'll give him some credit. His capital is way inland. It's nowhere near the ocean. It's not like Beijing today, much closer, or Shanghai, right?
And if it doesn't benefit the capital, why build it?
Why build it, right? Who cares about the peasants living along the coast? So speaking of the peasants, let's talk about who is working his infrastructure job to build the Grand Canal. So there is this book called Kai He Ji, literally the record of opening up a river. Okay, that was written by a Tang Dynasty author called Han Xie. And he described the miserable life of migrant workers who built parts of the Grand Canal.
I thought you were going to say like a freeway in China, but no.
Now, back in the days, we also had migrant workers. It's a great tradition.
Long history of abusing migrant workers in China.
Yes. So the Emperor Sui Yang, just like China and Xinjiang today, an emperor will require a cruel official who can do
the dirty work.
Who can do the dirty work. So we also have a cruel official here whose name is Ma Shumo. So Emperor Sui Yang sent Ma Shumo to be in charge of building the river. And they forced all men over the age of 15 to serve in this, you know, sort of like unofficially the army, which the army is the force to build it. A total of 3.6 million people were conscripted. In addition to all men over the age of 15, one person from every five families, this is China, by the way, we have great social control already at this time. We're like, every five families, one of you who is not a man, I guess, over 15, it might be someone young or old or a woman, because, you know, apparently we're not people. One of these people were selected to provide food and cooking for the worker. So, you know, they've got it all figured. They got the laborer. They got the support. He also dispatched 50,000 burly men. This is describing the book. I don't know what they define as burly, but they were burly men. Okay? They each carrying a stick as supervisors to urge the migrant workers to work. So you have a very tight system here. Not only you have conscripted laborers who are peasants, you have the woman or the young or the old man to cook and to clean. You also have managers who are probably maybe not peasants, maybe a little bit more stronger, grew up with more nutrition. And they would work as managers and they would carry a stick and they would be very harsh in terms of physical punishment if you're lazy or if they're just unhappy. So in less than a year, 2.5 million of those 3.5 million migrant workers died of harsh working conditions.
Yeah, and probably not enough food and everything else, weather.
Yeah, so it was a bloody ordeal, but the river was built.
I mean, you can imagine it. It's like, it's almost like if you're running construction equipment today.
Yeah.
And to like run like the excavator, you had to grind people up and feed it into it to make it run.
Exactly.
Every action in here, you have to feed a certain number of bodies into it per hour, probably per day.
Yes.
Right? You have to feed thousands into it per day to keep it running.
Yes.
And there's more showing up to take their place.
Yes, exactly. But what I do know is that the constructions were generally easier down south than up north. near the Yellow River.
Yeah.
And the Yangtze River was much more agreeable
yeah.
in many ways, and the waterways around it.
It's not China's sorrow.
Yes.
The other thing, though, with northern China is, like, when it gets to winter, like, if you're not properly prepared, you just die.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, you don't have to, which doesn't happen in the south as yes. much.
And you know what? The thing about water projects, not just in this dynasty, is, like, Yellow River changes its course. That canal over there, hundreds of people die to build,
yeah.
will be useless.
Yeah.
I don't know why we keep doing it, but we keep doing it.
Yeah.
It is like Sisyphus.
Yeah.
So he had a pretty ambitious schedule, even he did achieve it. So in just a few months after the construction started.
Well, he didn't achieve it. All the dead peasants did.
Well, I know, but when history talks about him, it's yeah. like, he's the one who, you know, I built it. So
he's like, I have an ambitious schedule. I mean, it'll only kill 1 million more peasants, but we'll get it done on time.
Exactly. In a few months, two major waterways were finished. One of them goes from Luoyang, the capital city, to Jiangdu, and this one was called Tongjiqu. The other one goes from Shanyang, a city, I guess, to Jiangdu, the same city, and this one is called Gango. And 3 years later, year 608, Yongjiqu was built, and this was a big one because it connects Beijing, today's China capital, way up north, to Luoyang, the capital city.
Mm.
In year 611, more was built. And Suiyang Emperor goes, you know what? This is the time for me to take a trip. So he had constructed a dragon boat. It doesn't literally look like a dragon, by the way.
But not a dragon boat. Like, not like the modern dragon boat.
No.
This is like,
but like a
this,
big boat.
This is like a barge, like a yacht.
Yes.
Okay.
A huge one for the time.
Because a modern dragon boat is a very nimble.
Well, affair. Apparently it's 4 stories tall.
Mm.
And he also built many, many other little boats to go with the fleet. However, because some of the waterway would be too shallow and the boat would be too heavy and
it
won't be able to flow in very Chinese fashion, that nothing can be solved by sacrificing thousands of peasants.
Yeah.
He had 80,000 laborers that dragged the boat and its fleet. 80,000, not just for one boat, not just for his dragon boat, but
stuck.
For the whole fleet, where the water would be too shallow and the boats got stuck using their backs.
Well, that's how all boats in China move.
When the water is too shallow.
No, but everywhere. That's how, I mean, they don't use sails. All boats in China on rivers, they have people.
Forever and ever?
Forever and ever. They tow them. I mean, if it's downstream, they can go downstream, but if it's upstream, they have people tow them.
Okay. Tow, that's the word I was looking yeah. for. Okay, well, this is...
They don't normally use 80,000, though.
No, but he did.
Yeah.
So he went from Jiangdu, I think, to north. I'm not sure he reached Beijing, but his whole trip only took 50 days.
Wow.
And probably also took many peasants' lives. So that was impressive. In year 210, he and the peasants finished the Jiangnan Canal part, which goes from Zhenjiang to Hangzhou. Hangzhou would be a famous port, a famous city today. And this part of the canal was 400 kilometers. In just a few years, he and the many peasants' lives completed the Grand Canal, the version of it at this time in the Sui Dynasty, that would range 2,000 kilometers long, which is pretty impressive at this time.
Yeah.
This was the 5th century, right?
Though some of that is going to be through probably existing waterways and other stuff, but I think a lot of it was...
Oh, yeah, a lot of it is through existing, but they're connecting yeah. existing waterways, right? So the question is, aside from a jobs project and what makes...
It's not really a jobs project if you don't get paid.
Or lives project,
yeah.
I guess.
Life. Overpopulation solving project.
Exactly. And to make Suiyang Emperor happy so he can go travel on his dragon boat, did it... actually work, you know, did it actually help society? Well, the history's conclusion is, yeah, in many ways. For example, cities along the waterway developed quite well, all thanks to the transportation benefits it added during this time. And you could argue that now we have a connection between the Jiangnan area, which is beginning to become the ritzier area compared to other parts of China. And now we have a connection in between the north and the middle and the south, which is quite convenient.
Yeah.
Not considering the lives that it had to sacrifice. But aside from all the benefits, all the traditional benefits of water projects, you know what else this canal did? The same year that the Grand Canal was completed was the same year that the Sui Dynasty collapsed. So the crash and burn, many thanks to especially the Grand Canal project. So I didn't get much into the technical details of the waterways. Yeah. I feel like maybe our Yellow River episodes gone into pretty good technical details of how these things can be built. And
I mean, I think if you listen to the last episode, we talked about the repair of the breach of the Yellow River.
Yes.
Like in the late Qing Dynasty. I mean, the techniques are not going to be that dissimilar, right? I mean, you get a bunch of people, you say, you know, we have to move this much dirt by, you know, or you know, everybody's got to move 1,000 buckets of dirt, you know, and eventually you do some math, you figure out, you know, how long it's going to take and you just do it. It's not like at some point they had invented a steam engine and,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And also there's other stuff about the Grand Canal, which I don't know, maybe we'll get into a later episode about the administration and the taxing and that kind of all that, but that's a whole separate thing.
Yes. Well, the next episode, we're definitely going to talk about the Tang Dynasty. I'm not sure how much beyond that. One thing about the Grand Canal that we know today is that it's commonly known as Sui Tang Da Yun He, which is Sui Dynasty, Tang Dynasty, Grand Canal.
Mm.
We have a version of the Grand Canal that's completed at this time in the Sui Dynasty, when the Sui Dynasty ended. But the Tang Dynasty, being a continued Sui Dynasty in many ways, also continued its efforts in building up the canal.
But the Yuan Dynasty and the Ming Dynasty, I mean, they're going to work on their own Grand Canal, right?
Yes.
And
then
the
Qing. I mean, this is sort of like the Great Wall.
Yeah.
Every dynasty has their own. Yeah. Are going to work on their own.
A lot of them are sort
of
just vaguely in the same area, but like they're, you know.
Yeah. Or if the Yellow River changes course back and you rebuild it again.
Yeah.
So this is the first part of our Grand Canal series.
Wow.
Maybe we didn't debunk all of what UNESCO has said, but that's the reason why you should listen to the next episode.
Is Cherry going to tear into the Grand Canal?
Yeah. Have I not enough?
We'll see.
Okay.
Well, anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you if you're being patient. I think we'll have a couple water margin episodes before we do the next one. I think the next one will probably be finish off talking about the Yellow River and its sort of modern state. But I think we need to give the water margin some love.
Yeah.
So
I kind of miss reading it.
I know. Well, hopefully you miss listening to it and you'll tune in to hear those episodes.
Yeah. So we'll see you next time.
Thank you.